Welcome to episode 7 of Teaching to Meet the Moment from the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education. I'm Mike Hines.
And I'm Nicole Luciani-Elliott.
And in today's episode, Leveraging Student Assets, we'll be talking about how teachers can shift their focus from teaching based on and from what our students don't know to teaching based on and from what our students do know.
Our students come to the classroom with an expansive set of experiences and a way of knowing, ways of knowing, that we can draw on for curriculum and instruction decisions. And this is something that we talk about in teacher prep. It's something that we talk about in the coffee room conversations that we all, at least we used to have when we were together in the coffee room. This is something that we all know. And all of the research on how people learn tells us that we must recognize and understand and then utilize the existing student knowledge in order to attach any new learning to things they already know and do. So I think about it like Velcro, right? One side of the Velcro is what they already know. The other side of the Velcro is the new learning. And really, we need both to be able to attach that knowledge and have it be sticky, as we say in the trade, so that the learning lasts, that the learning is meaningful, that the students can make sense of it, and they can integrate it into their knowing and doing. Without this Velcro approach between what they know and what they have yet to know, the learning just doesn't stick. And I know I'm probably preaching to the choir here, or maybe at least offering a good reminder. But as we listen today, I encourage all of us, and definitely me included, to reflect on how we are setting up our kids for these Velcro moments of meaningful and connected learning. And then to push my reflection deeper, I started to think about what we recognize in schools as knowledge, what counts as skills, what's assigned competency and given, you know, the gold star, so to speak. So to push my reflection deeper today, I'm going to use our time together to push me to really think about the knowledge that I actually recognize as knowledge. And I hope all of us will do the same here. We're long past the days where we see ourselves solely as disseminators of content. We know ourselves also to be teachers of skills. I just wonder, when we think about the skills that we're teaching, do we think about the skills that the kids already have? We're taking that Velcro metaphor and we're thinking about skills. Are we thinking about the skills they already come with, as opposed to the skills they don't yet have? And then are we in thinking about skills beyond reading and writing? Like, what counts as skills? Do we recognize social emotional skills like resilience and courage as something that we can attach to? Do we recognize cultural behaviors that may differ from the culture of school? Things like interdependence or direct communication or sociocentrism. Are we counting those as things that we can build on and attach new knowledge to? Do we recognize linguistic skills beyond standardized English, like the way students often seamlessly move between different forms of English, the way they weave in other languages quite often as well? And then I really want to consider, beyond recognizing those assets, how am I understanding them, and then how am I utilizing them? And that's really what we're setting up for us to think about today. How we leverage or fail to leverage our student assets, I think, may be the difference between meaningful learning, the kind of learning that feels relevant, that sticks, that inspires, and the kind of learning that does none of those things. So this is what I'm thinking about today, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation about identifying and centering and leveraging the assets of our students. I think we've got a lot to learn from them. So I welcome everybody to the show. And Mike, what do you think about getting started?
Absolutely. Let's start to introduce the panel. First up, we have Dr. Christopher Cormier. Dr. Cormier is a former special education teacher, and he's currently a postdoctoral scholar here at the Stanford University Graduate School of Education. Through his research, he examines the social and cultural context of minoritized learners and teachers, especially in special ed. Dr. Cormier is the current president-elect for the Division of Culturally and Linguistically Diverse Exceptional Learners of the Council for Exceptional Children, and he also serves as chair for the Research and Professional Issues Committee there. So welcome to Dr. Cormier.
Hello.
We also have Tim Lysico here. He's been teaching International Baccalaureate Language and Literature and Theory of Knowledge at Fridley High School, which is right outside Minneapolis, Minnesota, since 2005. In addition to teaching, Tim has served as an instructional coach, both observing and coaching teachers, as well as creating professional development. He's passionate about infusing culturally and linguistically responsive strategies into his classroom and into professional development to make sure that all students and all our adult learners have their cultural behaviors validated and affirmed. Tim's continued journey to responsiveness deepens his commitment to empowering all learners by creating a classroom that values all voices, especially those in need of what we call outrageous love in order to be heard. Welcome, Tim.
So good to be here. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And last but not least, Christina Johnson is joining us. Christina teaches 10th grade chemistry in a full inclusion setting at the Santee Education Complex in Los Angeles, where she also sponsors the Black Student Union. Christina is a member of Educators for Excellence, where she assists in the writing of policy recommendations for LA Unified School District around hybrid teacher roles, restorative justice, and instructional curriculum. She also currently serves as a teacher leader for Teach Plus's 2020-2021 cohort. Christina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, everybody. So the theme of today's episode is leveraging student assets. And this is kind of big and one of those things that we think we all know what we mean, but maybe we all mean something a little bit different. So we want from each of you to get a brief take on the what and how of leveraging student assets for you. So what comes to mind as you hear that phrase? And how do you think about the assets of students and what they can teach us about how to better serve them? So let's start with Christina, and then we'll kind of go around the horn from there.
So what really comes to mind is building on the strengths that our students have really to support them, identifying those strengths and building on them. And how I think about their assets, it's really about like students bringing a wealth of experiences. And when I went through my education, it was called like funds of knowledge that should really be celebrated to enhance their learning, such as their abilities to multitask, balancing work and family life, developing communication skills for the 21st century. Some of our students may have not emailed before, but they're learning how to do that, so we want to celebrate that. Students being able to advocate for themselves or create, having creativity, right? Developing coping skills. These are all assets that our students bring to the table. And what they teach me about how to better serve our students is that there are more innovative ways to for students to learn. Right. And students know best how they learn, how they want to receive information. And finally, using platforms such like social media are things that they already are really in tuned with to really reach out and engage my students on a day to day basis.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Tim, you're also a practicing teacher. You're not special ed, but you do focus on culturally and linguistically responsive teaching. So I'm wondering, what are your thoughts here?
I agree with everything Christina said, and would add to that that the best thing I can do is ask my students how they learn best. I mean, seriously, I think sometimes, and I'm very lucky that I have a 13-year-old and a son and 11-year-old daughter who are my primary teachers, and it's not these big elaborate pedagogical schemes that allow them to connect to teachers. It's teachers who ask them questions about who they are first, you know, and as cliched as it sounds, right, they are not going to care about what you know until they know you care. Mm. And I think that's the foundation of outrageous love and truly getting out of the way. The classroom space is not about me. I think for me, the idea of leveraging assets goes back to my first thing that got me passionate about learning, and I would even just say life, was theater. I'm a theater kid from way back when. I did show choir. I'm going to admit that right now to everyone, a show choir kid. And that's all about celebrating what each individual is bringing and you know, taking that into the bigger total picture of who we are, and knowing that we need each part of that at its best, right? Or else the whole is going to suffer. So to me, it's about empowering the students to see themselves as the best version of who they are, first and foremost.
Thank you. Christopher, I'm wondering what you have to add as a former teacher and now postdoctoral fellow with a lot of research under your belt. When you think about adult learners and or student learners, what comes to mind for you for the leveraging student assets and how they can teach us how to better serve them?
Thank you. Particularly, I think about my work with students with special needs. And the reason is because there's such a deficit attitude towards this particular population of students. And this exists in public schools today. It's not something that occurred prior to IDEA or Brown or anything. The attitudes towards how students are leveraged and where they're positioned in schools based on their abilities is disheartening. And so it also then creates this rift between special ed and general education teachers, where there's this belief that that everyone is coming together for the benefit of the student, but collaboration really does not happen in the way in which that our textbooks at least teach teachers that it should. So the reason I share that is because I feel that for students with special needs, one way to leverage on their assets is to first understand that they come with assets in the first place. Because the reality is that many people have this attitude towards these students that they have an IEP and that, let's say they're in the 12th grade. And I had students in the 12th grade who didn't even know how to decode, but there were things that they knew that they brought to the table. And so with what Christina was saying, what is it that they can do? And some students, even before the pandemic, they were great at technology. There are things that they can teach me even how to do that I didn't even know how to do. I had students that would create YouTube videos that I before it was the popular thing to do, or just a variety of things, fixing an issue with the computer when the tech person couldn't get there in time. Mm-hmm. What are the things that we can think of that these students bring, and understanding that they bring an asset? And I think that if we, first and foremost, if we have school systems that understand that all students matter and not just the ones, I'll push this and say, not just the ones that are bringing high test scores to our state standardized tests, then we'll have a much more robust environment. And the last thing I'll say with that is, when I was teaching, I always pushed my students further than what was also expected. So, for example, if I'm teaching a high school class and students can't read, that doesn't mean that I'm still not going to try for us to read Moby Dick or To Kill a Mockingbird. We may struggle with it. We may not even get through the whole book. But the fact of the matter is that I'm letting them do the same things that are being done in other classes, and I'm pushing them, and it's hard, and they get frustrated, and the words are difficult, and they don't always understand. But under letting them know, even some of my own challenges that I've had academically, professionally, lets them know that I'm a real person. And so I think that the big thing is just understanding, and I speak of it from students with special needs, because these are the students who are most vulnerable on campus, but are also usually the most shunned away. And my environment when I taught was usually in a back corner in a bungalow. And it was, the attitude is, it be seen and not heard. And I think, so if we can understand that these students bring some level of asset and they're human beings, that we can have a much more robust and welcoming place, and the students will do better for it as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Christina, I see big smiles and lots of nods. So talk to us. You've had a really wide range of special ed experience teaching SDC and now RSP. What's your reaction to Christopher's suggestion and to this notion of maintaining expectations and really being a support? You're not letting them drown by any means, but you're also not enabling them and pretending that they can't rise to an occasion. Share with us any thoughts you have, maybe some experiences from your classroom that you might offer.
I was just so excited that there's someone else in a room who also feels the same way that I do. Recently, our school went full inclusion, and really what, again, that means is that our students who were in a specialized population have now been integrated into the general ed classrooms. In that first year, my class, I was selected to be the only class, only teacher on campus to go full inclusion before the entire school did it. And I remember my co-teacher and I just having conversation after conversation about how we had to be asset-based when we were going into our classroom each day, how we had to consider that our students were going to surprise us. And sometimes even as a special ed teacher, I was there like, I don't know if they can get there. And she was the one who had to remind me that we have to continue to provide them with high expectations. So even if the student doesn't get there, we know that they maybe they fell short, but we could reflect on that and find a way to really get them to that point. And at the end of the year, and I say this with such a smile and so much pride, because at the end of the year, the students with the highest grades in each one of our classes were actually our SDC students. Because at that point, they were still considered SDC because they were only fully included in science. And that was because we developed a relationship with our students. We got to know our students. We had restorative circles. We talked to our students, you know, at lunch, after school, before school. They would come to us with problems in their other classes. And we expressed to them that they have assets. They have experiences, they have knowledge that they can bring to the classroom. And once they took hold of that, when we would have discussions, they were no longer meek, you know, head bowed, eyes low, because that's what they were used to, being in the back of the school. They were now opening their mouths, sharing their experiences, you know, thinking back to other units we had done, drawing connections. And it was so cool to even talk to my co-teacher about, you know, students who could be considered twice exceptional. Individuals may look at a student, you know, who has autism and say, oh, they're going to have so many issues socially in this general ed classroom, not considering all of the knowledge and the details that they're going to bring to that classroom, because sometimes they would point out things that maybe I hadn't even considered. And so it's so beautiful to hear another individual share, you know, some of those sentiments and to add to that, because our students are not theys and thems. They are not meant to be put in the back, put in a corner. They are meant to shine and they do have a light.
Thank you. Thank you. Chris, you want to add to that real quick? I see you might have something to add. And as you chime in here, I'm wondering if you might also speak to the importance of naming those. You and Christina both mentioned this idea of naming the assets that kids come with, not just saying you're so smart, but like really identifying specific assets. And then you also mentioned the importance of owning your own story and sharing that. So I'm wondering, as you respond to Christina's thoughts, if you could add those things in as well.
Yes, thank you. Two quick things. But one, I wanted to leverage off of something, but leveraging is the title of our presentation. Leverage off of something that Tim had mentioned earlier. One of the things I remember when I was teaching is that understanding of making that community, you talked about making that connection with students. And that often doesn't happen for students, particularly with special needs, for unless it's the special education teacher or the person that they're having those services with. And so even with Christina mentioning how, you know, going to a full inclusion model, schools have this expectation that everyone's going to be on board, and that you're kind of setting the special education teacher up for failure because you're infiltrating their classroom, even though, but that's a whole nother story that I won't get into right now. You know, I'm a SPED person, so I can go on and on about that topic. But going back to what Tim had said, as far as, I remember when I was teaching, and this was years ago, there was a show on Nickelodeon called iCarly. And I remember talking to my students and saying to them, trying to make a connection early in the school year, asking them what TV shows that they liked. And they were all of these adult shows that they were naming. And it was obvious to me that they were trying to put on a front. Now, mind you, these were sixth, seventh, and eighth graders that didn't want to say that they were watching Nickelodeon shows. So I then started saying, well, that's surprising, because my wife and I this weekend, we were watching Drake and Josh and iCarly, and I was telling them about the episode, and they fell out laughing. And then all of a sudden, they started talking about the episode. And I said, wait a minute, you told me that you don't watch the show. So I really love how, Tim, when you mentioned about making those connections with students, because even when I had a student that was said he had YouTube videos, and it wasn't anything inappropriate, he was doing skateboarding tricks. But me taking time out of my schedule when I got home, of looking at those videos and being able to talk to them about it to get him to do his work, is ways in which that we can, one, leverage those assets because we're making connections with the students that often, you know, doesn't happen. People don't take the time to do that. As far as the specific question you asked, I think the emotional understanding from an emotional aspect, and again, I apologize if I'm only speaking about students who have special needs, but that's just the population that I've worked with when I taught. My first year of teaching, there was a field trip that we were taking the students on, and they were taking the students to a place called in LA in Anaheim called Medieval Times, and one of the chair of the eighth grade English department said to me, "Hey, we're taking the eighth grader students to Medieval Times, but it's tomorrow. And I apologize. I know that we forgot to include you. I know that you probably can't make it, but if you can get all these permission slips by tomorrow." I surprised them. I called every single parent and I talked to my students. Every single one of them, all 12 of them, came to school. I even told the parents, "I will come to your house after school and get these permission slips signed if I have to." Every single student, they were surprised when I got to work the next day that I had every single permission slip. When we get on the bus and there was turmoil where some of the students were their behavior was questionable. It wasn't mine though. After the field trip, the eighth grade teacher who developed this field trip came to me and apologized and said, "I want to apologize. Your students were the best behaved on the whole trip and you were able to do this. And we never expected that because the expectation was that your kids would be the ones that are acting up." The students that I had were the students that are seen as the ones that are often left behind. Mm. But my students behave better than anyone else on that entire field trip. So I think having an understanding of even emotional expectations, what do we expect of these kids emotionally? We look at students who have special needs or who are different, and we make this assumption that they can't learn, that they're going to act a certain way. And the reality is that they're never even given an opportunity. They're never even given a seat at the table. And I think that is one of the things. So when you're saying specifics, it's what are the opportunities that we're even presenting? If everyone else is getting an opportunity to go on a field trip, why aren't the students who are even in a life skills class invited? Is it because you don't want to pay for another bus to provide them the services? If students are getting an opportunity to do a reading program, even though we may know, I know that Pizza Hut, I don't know if they still do it. They used to do a program called Book It, where you would have the Pizza Hut and you would write out the books that you would get. And then when you fill out 10, you'd get a personal pan pizza. A lot of times students with special needs or even students who are seen as behavior problems are not even given an opportunity to show. And the fact of the matter is that may be their ticket. They may act up, one, because they don't like the teacher, one, because they're not being challenged enough. Maybe the student who has the perceived behavior challenges loves to read, but there's never given an opportunity to read things for pleasure. So finding ways in which to infuse other types of ways that we can teach students. And it's not just about being culturally responsive. It's just about being responsive first and also culturally responsive. But if the kid likes to read, I wouldn't say lowrider magazines, those are probably not the best ones to think of. But if a student likes to read about rap music, then maybe we find a way to infuse that into his curriculum as a way, at least he's reading. And I think that the challenge is that we're so rigid on what the expectations of the school are and what the curriculum is supposed to be that students are often left behind and are not even given a chance. So I'll stop there because I can go on a soapbox with this, but thank you for that. I hope I answered it appropriately.
Thank you.
Well, guys, I'm loving the conversation so far. I'm loving what I'm hearing about. First of all, believing that students have assets, right? Believing that they have these funds of knowledge, that they have these different, from my background, right? These different forms of capital, right? That might go unrecognized. And then giving them opportunities to use that and to show that. And I wanted to get Tim into the discussion a little bit more. I wanted to ask from what Christopher and Christina were already saying, how does this translate to your environment working in culturally and linguistically responsive teaching, but particularly in an IB setting, right? Particularly at this sort of different level or different kind of class that you're working in, different kind of school. How do you seek out the cultural assets of your students and how do you give them those opportunities to show?
Well, I'm just having a lot of fun listening, and I have to say, so I I think it is important, the context here. The district I am in is small. We're about 2,700 students total. And we have an inclusion model towards IB. So we're a K-12 district. And so everyone in IB, kindergarten through 10th grade, is meant to be a open access. Everyone's involved. And that is infused into our special ed, our EL, every program that we have. And then I do teach at the 11th and 12th grade level, which is part of what's known as diploma program, which I guess AP could be a corollary to it. We intentionally shifted our model from DP literature about 6-7 years ago to language and literature, because the Christopher was saying about leveraging what a student loves to read. At the heart of the language and literature course is this idea that we need to be equally studying what we might call traditional literary texts, you know, poetry, drama, novel, those genres, but also equally studying and giving primacy to non-literary texts. And they don't mean that as a pejorative. It really means like I have a unit studying commercials using, you know, YouTube, obviously. I have a unit studying hashtags. I have a unit studying TikTok. I have a, you know, the using what the students are bringing that they're passionate about. It makes everything better. And honestly, it's way more fun to teach, quite frankly. And you mentioned To Kill a Mockingbird and Moby Dick. I hope I can go the rest of my career with not having to teach those ever again. So and not that I don't love, quote unquote, you know, classical literature or whatever, but in doing that too, we opened up the programming. There's two different levels, and just, I don't know, kind of the silliness of labeling stuff. One is called higher level and then one is called standard level. But at that standard level course in 11th grade, I'm often getting students who are coming to a quote unquote general ed English classroom for the first time. And that has been transformative in my career for the last 5 years, infusing CLR strategies that I agree with you, Christopher. It's about being responsive. It's about, I want students to have way more voice in the class, not just in what's being said. Obviously, that's important. They didn't come to listen to me talk for 45 minutes, but also a little bit of choice in what we're doing. And that's the beauty of infusing. I've learned so much about, you know, contemporary music and whether it's TVs, movies. I feel like students are way more into shorter form. So whether it's, you know, TikTok or whatever app that's happening that I have no idea about because I'm too old for it now. But it's so cool to have those students. And so I have, you know, within, and this is such a weird year with the structures, I'm in a hybrid teaching model, but like if I was in a regular school year with 30 students, I would have 5 or 6 students on IEPs. And the beauty of being in a smaller school, I think, is that we do work in more concert with our special ed teachers to make sure that we're meeting, you know, the very important IEP moments. But also, I think what it shows is for all students that we're all bringing something that is useful and beneficial to our classroom culture. And I'll stop here, but I would love to chat about, because what Nicole mentioned at the very beginning, I teach a class called Theory of Knowledge, which again has just the title alone sounds pretty, you know, academic and hoity-toity, but my favorite students to have in that class are the students who don't see themselves. Like I will start class the semester with, tell me how you're smart. And I'll tell them, you're not allowed to say I'm not smart, because you're smart. It just may not be in the way that school is always define smart. And it's so exciting to see students come alive and share. And then that moves into a unit where I have students lay out what they would see as their ideal education system. And spoiler alert, it looks nothing like the education system we're all employed in right now, which is equal parts depressing, but also hopeful, because you know, the students are our greatest. Like when we talk about leveraging assets, that is the greatest untapped resource, right, is truly engaging them and letting them feel as valuable in the decision making as teachers are, right?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. I was nodding so much while you were talking, because I can relate even teaching at the college level now, but teaching seventh grade before, but definitely now I can relate to learning from students who are just on the cutting edge in ways that I'm not, right? I am teaching a history of African American education. And the final projects that my students are coming up with, when they have the freedom to go in different directions, right? Some of them want to do a traditional research paper, right? Some of them want to do, Chicago style citations and, write me 15 pages. But others want to approach me with ideas for podcast episodes, right? Others want to approach me with ideas for educational TikToks, like series of TikTok videos. And like the way that they explain, right? The way that they incorporate some of the scholarly knowledge, right, that we have into these various forms is just amazing, right? So I think even at the graduate school level, even at the college level, right, giving students the opportunity to take their learning in the direction that they want to is really important. Something that I've noticed reading all of your bios is that all of you work in some way, shape, or form with teacher preparation, right? Whether it's through instructional coaching, whether it's through teaching at the college level, or maybe being at the department level within your own school, observing teachers, being a mentor teacher. Something that I wanted to know from all three of you is, how do you push colleagues, right, to adopt asset-based approaches? How do you push those co-teachers? How do you push those teachers that you might be mentoring? How do you push those teacher candidates in your classroom to adopt this asset-based approach to teaching and learning? And what pushback do you receive, if any, right? Christina's already like, ooh. let's go back to Christina to start, and then we can see if others want to chime in.
Thank you. So I really believe that the greatest deficiency in education is our obsession with showcasing deficits, right? It's this idea that, oh, these students are coming in and they don't have this, they're losing this, what have you. And I sometimes understand it, it's because we need to see what you're quote unquote lacking so I can get you what you need to be where quote unquote you're supposed to be. Where the flip side of that is, let me see what you're bringing to the table, and then let me give you some more so then you can level up. And when working with my colleagues, when working with mentees or even mentors, people who coach, I think that we have to return to the definition of an asset, right, in its most fundamental sense. When we think about an asset, we need to realize that it's a resource, right? Whether it's a resource exploited as some form of capital or utilized as a skill, it is still a resource. And I believe that in order for someone to really identify and build on students' assets, you have to confront a truth. And that truth is really that assets are best understood in specific like social and cultural contexts. And what I really mean by that, again, is that like one's perception of another's assets is rooted in their like indoctrinations. So if I cannot look at you in my social or even economic or academic context, I may be looking at you from a deficit. So typically when individuals are interacting with our students with special needs, they're coming at it from a quote unquote general education perspective. I'm not thinking about how you're thinking. I'm not thinking about the ways in which you interact or engage with this curriculum. And so I am sometimes subconsciously just coming at you from a deficit mindset. And so it's really important for us as educators to help other individuals confront that truth so that when they go into the classroom, they're not looking at these students as lacking, but looking at these students as wealthy. And I really do that on my campus by hosting professional developments on inclusion and diversity, in which we work with our colleagues who may be becoming co-teachers on changing their vocabulary. There's also this sense that if you're in a full inclusion classroom, and my co-teacher doesn't do this, but I have seen this where those are your students. Oh, you're a special ed teacher. Those are your students. These are my kids. I'm going to work with these students. No. They're all of our students. Okay. The general ed kids are mine too. We're working with all of our students. And so what it's happened from doing that is we've had visitors come on campus, come into my classroom, come into other teachers' classrooms. And before they'll leave, they will ask, who was the special ed teacher? They don't know. They can't identify it because we're all working with the students at the same level. And I think it's also pushing it forward and working with the administration, helping the administration see that this is necessary. It's important to have these continued professional developments on campus that highlight ways for teachers to communicate with students with disabilities. But not just communicate with them, but also assist those students in advocating for themselves and developing an appreciation for their own assets, not just saying, hi, my name is such and such, and I have an auditory processing delay. No. It's hi, my name is such and such, and I learn best through visuals. And you may have to repeat something to me, but I'll still get it. And then finally, it's really working with first-year teachers through mentorship. I'm currently mentoring one of our Los Angeles Urban Teacher Residency, our residents, working with Teach for America and their incoming first and second-year students on looking at our students as asset-based. And again, at my school site. And some of the pushback is typically, if I don't want to teach them, do I have to? We've gotten that. Or I don't think they'll be able to get it. So maybe I should just cut the assignment in half. The other things we've heard is, he tried, so I gave him an A. So those are the major things that we have to combat on a daily basis. But it's really building a team, building capacity, a capacity on campus, and knowing that the knowledge about asset-based learning isn't just in me. It has to be shed abroad so others can take hold of it and we can continue to build that culture on our campus.
That's awesome. Christopher, Tim, either one of you want to chime in or build off of what Christina's already saying about building that capacity, right, in our colleagues and in the next generation of educators.
I'm going to be really upset when this is over with today. Christina, I could hear you talk for an hour or so. So I agree with everything that you are saying. As far as I will say to not have this go at, this is just my experience here at Stanford. This is in teacher education. It's just, there is just challenges regardless. I have pushed teachers. My approach probably is not the most popular, but I feel it works. And so I give a few examples. One, I personally, when I was in my teacher ed program, I did not like looking at a CUM file of students prior to going in, because the reality was, in order to combat this, I would have a backdoor way of kind of approaching it. One, I often tell teacher candidates to not hang out in the teacher's lounge. Being in the teacher's lounge is a deficit. The conversations around students are usually never productive. And the students that get the short end of the stick usually are minority students and usually students who have special needs. And so not engaging in those conversations, one. And also by looking at a CUM file, so as a SPED teacher, you have to look at the IEP before because you can't, but there's much more detail in a CUM file and there's much more detail in what we call the triennial IEP that has much more information. I try to gather as much information as I need to just to understand the student, but not go as so far as reading through all of their disciplinary infractions and everything. Because if I do that, I've already set myself up to have a certain attitude towards the student going into the school year. And it's difficult to shake that. It's almost like dating someone and someone's telling you all these bad things about them. And once you go out on the date, that's all you can see. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've learned is that those students that often are seen as the most difficult were the students that I never had a problem with. They were the students that I had the best relationships with not saying that there aren't challenges with students at times, but generally I find ways of also letting teacher candidates know that you need to also open some of yourself up to them. So for me, my opening that up was explaining to them that I wore a certain tie every day to work. That was just my thing. But it was something that was kind of ingrained in me and my teacher ed program. But I also let the students know I come from the same environment that you come from. I explain to them, certain things that they've struggled with. When it's talking about, you know, something that's going on in their life, I try to leverage that. Sometimes it's an issue with a boy or girl or some dating, or sometimes it's a family issue. So these are the things that I've told teacher candidates in order to be aware of, to make one, again, going back to Tim's point, to making those connections. The other thing that I also often try to make clear is when I have supervised teachers, one thing that it wasn't required, but what I did anyways, was I asked them to come back to me every week when we met and tell me something that they noticed unethical in their schools. I've never been short of something coming back to me that's not been unethical. Now, here's the thing. As an instructor, I'm not going to play like I know all the answers, like I know how to solve whatever those issues are. But here's my challenge that I feel that we fail teachers and teacher ed, and why so many leave, and why I'm so just impressed with what Stanford is doing, not just because I work here, but what they're doing with teacher candidates, is the fact that if I'm opening these teachers up to know that if we're just going week by week and I'm teaching what's in the textbook, then they're leaving their teacher ed program with this perception that teaching is this utopia and that everything is perfect and that I'm going to go into a school and this is how it is. And we're setting teachers up for failure. They need to know that it is a great place, it is a great profession, but it's not without its messiness. And so for them coming in and understanding what are those challenges that they often are going to face, I may not be able to answer that. Maybe we do it as a class discussion. When the class comes around and saying, this came up, do you mind if I share? And I won't share your name. And the class is able to rally. And we may still not have the answer. But recognizing to go in a teacher ed program and to just assume that everything is great and that I'm so excited to teach, that can still be there. But you need to be very aware that there are challenges that are faced when you get into that classroom. And the last thing with what Christina had said, as far as the grades, I had teachers when I was teaching that would give special education students a C, because the attitude is, and this is even taught at Stanford with some of our cooperating teachers, tell them you cannot fail special education students. That is a falsity. That is untrue. Just because you have an IEP, it is not true that you cannot fail. The IEP is meant to serve as a barrier, because the attitude is that from a legal perspective, students should not fail if you're individualizing the instruction. Now, common sense would say that with 10, 15, 20 students, are we really individualizing their instruction? No. But the fact of the matter is that these students can fail. And as a SPED teacher, it's rare, but I have failed students. What I always tell candidates is you need to make sure your documentation is there and very clear on why. So you need, every time you're calling a parent, you need to write, I called, they didn't answer. If they say some words, some choice words to you, write it down. Everything that's happened, the student doesn't show up. So the reason I'm sharing all this is because there are unique things that we're setting teachers up for failure by not having these and giving these falsities and saying, you can't fail the kids, you can't do this, you can't do that. That's not true. We also need to make sure that they understand that there are unique responsibilities that come with teaching students, but also not to allow the negative attitudes that, whether it's their cooperating teacher, whether it's the principal, whether it's someone who's been there for 30 years, have about these kids. Because if you walk into a school your first year and you hear that in the lounge, it will have you to want to leave teaching immediately. Yeah. I'm also going to throw into the chat, it was on the bio, but there's an article that just came out that I wrote that dealt with some ways of leveraging student assets. And I'm just going to, as soon as you click on it, hopefully not now when we finish, it'll open up a PDF that'll kind of engage in some of these topics as well.
Thank you. Thank you. What I feel like I'm hearing both you and Christina talk about is this idea of balancing asset focus, and we're also still teaching, right? This isn't it's not the gravy train that we all just jump on and love each other until it's over, right? And so, and to really arm teachers with that notion of high standards and what Tim and I in our other life work call outrageous love, right? The warm demander pedagogy that puts our arm around our kids and says, I love you. We're going to get this done. Right. And it's not enabling. And I think that's so important for teachers to hear. Tim, I want to bring this to you because you do work in your own school, certainly, but you're also coaching around the country for the Center for Culturally and Linguistically Responsive Teaching and Learning. And so I'm wondering for you, kind of, how do you push colleagues at your own site? Yeah. And then how do you push colleagues who you don't know? Like, you have teaching in common, but you're not from their school, maybe even from their state. So talk to us about how you support our teachers in both realms.
Well, I first want to say, you know, I still go back to, I remember it was actually in Andrew's classroom, just down the hall here, and taking notes on your recommendations for coaching. So I literally have those whenever I go anywhere, especially not in my own site. So thank you, Nicole. And then I'll give a shout out to Lydia, who I know did the podcast a few weeks ago. It really has to be about questions and then being very intentional with, you know, I think starting with, you know, in our work with CLR, you know, and this is true of every educator, we have to know who we are first and foremost. We really have to do that deep identity work. And I'll just say this as a white heterosexual male middle-aged teacher, I got to do a lot of deep work because it's very easy for me to look around and go, man, school works. I don't know what everyone's issue is. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's the first, you know, thing that I've had the, you know, privilege of working in CLR. It's helped deepen my identity and interior work. And then sharing that with teachers and asking them, you know, starting with like, where are you on your journey to responsiveness? Talk to me a little bit about, you know, before we get into the actual like skill set, you know, technical stuff, which is important because if I'm a teacher who just, you know, kind of says, I love every student, but I don't have any way of helping students develop skills, you know, it's to me just as problematic as if I have a mindset of, you know, only these students can succeed, I'm not going to help those students either. I mean, you know, it's that mindset, skill set paradigm. And I think one thing that I don't ask all the time that I'm going to start doing more of is talk to me about the last time you were amazed by a student. And if I'm not doing that in my own practice on a daily basis, then I got to slow down. I got to go, okay, I'm focused on the wrong things. Like I'm so caught up in the, you know, whether it's on the paperwork side of, which is very real. Whenever mm-hmm. I want to practice some deep empathy for a colleague, I go and look at IEP paperwork. I mean, that is some intense stuff, right? But you know, we all have that paperwork in education. And so what am I doing to make sure that I am finding opportunities to authentically, as we would say, validate and affirm? Mm-hmm. And then I like to talk to teachers about, I'll say stuff like, you know, that the build and bridge you have going on, which would be the more traditional school culture that, you know, most teenagers are going to, I work with teenagers, so I'll put it in that context. Most teenagers are going to push back against. Most teenagers don't show up to school going, this is my natural way of being. I like to sit in the desk and raise my hand. I mean, so if all I'm doing is building and bridging all day long, that's going to be really difficult to have students, whatever, you know, they're bringing, it's going to be very difficult for them to see. And so to Christopher's point, if I'm, you know, a student who's been marginalized by the traditional school system, and all I'm being told over and over is I don't match this one very narrow version of what it means to be successful in student in school, you know, I don't know why would I keep showing up? I mean, I think that is the true, you know, the true skill set of so many of our students who are showing up despite the fact that a system is telling them you don't have any, you know, the value you bring is in your compliance. Like that to me is the most heartbreaking part of our education system is that what we wind up teaching a lot of times is that if you comply really well, mm-hmm. you're doing it, you're making it. And of course mm-hmm. that has no place in any post school life. No, if you're going to go work for, you know, a company or whatever, or you're going to go on your own, compliance is like the least helpful skill, yet that's what we prioritize so much in our grading and our behavior management systems, in our teacher education programs, and the way we talk to each other about students. It's you know, so much of those conversations that you're talking about in the teacher's lounge can be driven by compliance. And I'm going to be very honest right now. I struggle. And so what I do a lot of times, like Christopher was saying, is I seek out those people that fill my bucket. Right. At this point, I do my best to kind of share my joys, but like, I'm not going to spend a lot of time. I think by and large teachers will gravitate towards that. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll see that. So like you're walking the talk, right?
Right, right. Oh my goodness. I mean, I feel like we could continue to talk for an hour, and I tell my colleagues how much I think about going back into the classroom all the time, having taught for 20 years and now being in teacher education for the last 7. I miss the classroom so much, and it's conversations like this. Like, I feel like, Christopher, sign me up for SPED. I'm going to go back, and Christina's going to be my mentor, and Tim's going to be the angel on my shoulder reminding me. And it's just talking about filling your bucket, spending the last hour with the three of you has just been such a gift. And I feel like the big takeaways I have are thinking about Christina's comment about seeing our kids as wealthy and being our largest untapped resource for what we could and should be learning, right? What a gift the three of you have shared with us today in your time and in your wisdom. Mike, any closing words?
No, it was an amazing conversation. I would just really reiterate just a huge thank you to all three of our panelists for taking the time to join us today. And I would let everybody know that next week we bring season 1 of Teaching to Meet the Moment to a close. We're going to be looking forward to sort of think about what we've learned and how it might apply in this sort of ever-changing context, right? And what the next school year might hold. And what we want to bring into the end of this school year, the summer, and the next school year. So it's going to be an awesome conversation. So please join us for that next week.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, everybody. Have a great night. Thank you all for joining us so much.
Thanks, guys.